The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for the talk today, I want to start with a story I'm fond of as an introduction to what I'll be talking about. There was a person who was well-learned in Buddhism, many years studying with the great teachers of the era, studied all the great books and sutras and commentaries. But then at some point went to a Zen master and with a piece of beautiful paper, calligraphy paper, and asked the Zen master to do a calligraphy, to write down the most important teaching of Buddhism on this calligraphy. And there's a tradition, especially in Japan, that Zen masters will do calligraphy, and sometimes they're on scrolls, and their scrolls are hung in a respectful place in a home. And so in that custom, the person went to the Zen master and made that request. And so the Zen master thought about it for a while and then wrote, with great focus and presence, wrote something on the scroll. And the person was very excited that this great Zen master was going to write the essential kind of nugget of what Buddhism is about. And the Zen master wrote on the character in Japanese for attention. Just that one word, attention, single character. And the Zen master and the person said, "Oh no, you seem to not quite understood. I want the most important, the essential, the key teaching." And so the Zen master took another piece of paper and with great focus and presence wrote another two characters now. And the person was very excited to see it now, but certainly there'd be something profound. And the Zen master had written, "Attention, attention." So then the person explained, you know, they're well studied, they've read all the great philosophies of Buddhism, they really have surveyed the whole terrain, lots of teachers they've studied with, and they're sophisticated, and they know a lot already. So, you know, can you really kind of capture the essence of the philosophy of the teachings of, you know? And the Zen master says, "Oh, now I understand. Okay." And took another piece of paper and with great focus and presence, looked at the paper, composed attention in the moment, grounded here, and then wrote, "Attention, attention, attention." So this idea of attention is so important for this tradition, for Buddhism. And everything you need to know and need to occur in Buddhist practice happens through the vehicle of paying attention, being attentive to what's going on. A beginning class in meditation would tell you to start being mindful, start engaging your attention in the present moment. So in some ways it can be seen as beginner's practice. But it's the same practice for someone who has been practicing for years, someone who has matured in the practice, reached full maturity for it. It's still attention. The core practice is the same. And so the practice of a beginner and the practice of someone who's practiced for a long time is in some ways the same. And people who practice for a long time, it's always good to go back to the beginning, to really start over again in a sense. But we start over again if we've done practice for a long time. We don't quite start over. The practice is the same, attention. The basic instructions might be the same as for a beginner. But we bring something along. Something accompanies us from the maturity of our practice that creates a little different context for doing the basic practice. What I'd like this talk to be about is an introduction to meditation practice. And so it's meant for people who are maybe pretty new to all this. Maybe this is your first time coming to talk at IMC. And also some of you I know have practiced for a long time. And I hope it's going to work for you too, that you don't say, you know, you're ready to, you know, turn off the YouTube channel because, oh, it's just going to be an introduction to meditation. I know all too well what meditation is about. And I hope that you'll appreciate as these minutes that I talk that I'll offer something a little different. So the reason for this topic is that my current plan, which is subject to change by tomorrow morning, but is to, for the next few weeks on the 7 a.m. teaching that I do, to go through the basic instructions in meditation practice that I teach here at IMC, and I teach a 5-week intro to meditation class periodically. And that follows a pattern. And the pattern is the first evening, we talk about breathing. The second evening, we talk about body, mindfulness of the body. The third day is mindfulness of emotions. The fourth one is mindfulness of thinking. And then the fifth time is everything else, kind of. And so I thought we would go through that 1 week at a time. So a week on breathing, a week on body, a week on emotions, and a week on thinking, and then maybe a week or two or some other things. And I feel it's really, really useful to come back to the beginning, to basics for everyone. And as I said, I think that basics are not just basics for people who have a lot of experience. It's still the basic practice, but hopefully something accompanies that. There's a understanding, an insight, an approach to starting over again that is both just starting over again, sharing the practice of a beginner, but somehow there's something else is happening there along with it. And so that's the plan. And so this talk today is a little bit like an introduction to this series that I'm planning to do. So I wanted to take the opportunity to contextualize, a little step back a little bit, more objectively contextualize the instructions in meditation that I've been doing here during this pandemic time, and also at IMC, and how it fits into the larger scene. Because all instructions are, probably not best choice of words, but are contrived, are artificial. They're something that are constructed and made and presented. And as such, they have history. And the way that I teach this 5-week intro class at IMC, I'll tell you the origins of it. So when I went to practice Vipassana, insight meditation, in Thailand and Burma, the instructions were very simple. In fact, in Burma, I showed up at kind of like the ground headquarters, that's ground zero for the whole, in some ways, the Vipassana movement that spread into the West. And they gave me a cassette and a cassette player with a 15-minute instructions in the meditation. And that was the extent of the instructions that I was supposed to, I used for then for 8 months that I was on retreat there. All the instructions were given in 15 minutes. And the simplest way of repeating those 15 minutes is focus on the sensations of your breathing. And if something becomes more predominant, more compelling than your breathing, let go of the breathing and bring your attention to really see what it is that's pulling you away or what's more compelling. And when that's settled enough, somehow it doesn't have to stop, but settled enough and no longer so compelling, go back to your breathing. And so it was a lovely practice for me to discover, because in doing Zen practice before that, the focus was so much on breathing and on posture that there was no instructions for emotions, for thinking, for all the kind of wider range of our experience. And Vipassana, I learned that this simple instructions included this wider, all of our humanity. Everything was included. And I remember when I was, after practicing in Burma for a while, I got so happy when I realized at some point that distance practice taught me to be mindful, be present for everything in my experience. And the reason I became so happy was that I knew that if I was mindful, there was a way of being free, liberated from experience. And this idea that that no matter what the human experience is, because I knew now how to be mindful of it, I could find some kind of freedom, some kind of peace, some kind of independence, some kind of autonomy, disentanglement with it all. And I still couldn't do it so well, but I knew the theory. I could be free anywhere I go if I keep practicing mindfulness. So that was what the instructions was, very simple. There's certainly more that happened in those 15 minutes of instructions, but it was all done like that. So I came to practice a little bit here in the West, and then at some point I was invited to become a teacher in this Vipassana tradition. And only then did I really kind of start attending Western insight meditation retreats. I hadn't done a lot of things here in the West. And here I've discovered they taught the instructions in a different way. On retreats, they would start on the first day teaching about breathing meditation, kind of get grounded, get settled. The second day, they talk about mindfulness of the body, partly because by the second day, people's bodies were aching and challenging. The third day, they would talk about instructions in mindfulness of emotion. And by third day, that was often kind of challenging for people, so that was useful. And the fourth day, they talk about mindfulness of thinking. And then there'd be some other things the next days of the retreat. And that was a pattern. And so I was introduced to that pattern, and I thought this was a nice pattern. As part of my teacher training starting in 1990, I was asked to take over a group, a small meditation group in Palo Alto. And I taught them for every week for about a year and a half or so, until it became clear it would be useful to do in instructions in meditation for people. So then I offered the first time. But I had never received any kind of basic meditation class, instructions in meditation class, which I was about to teach. And so I didn't have any reference points for how you do it. And I certainly wasn't going to do the 15-minute instructions that I got in Burma. So I said, well, the way that they're taught on retreat, that's a very nice sequence. And it leads up to the way we were taught in Burma, because after you get the full set of instructions, then you know how to be present for everything. And that was what they're building to on the retreats by the fifth, sixth day. Then the instructions were similar to what they are in Burma. So I thought, why don't I teach a five-week course following the instructions on the retreats? And one of the reasons I was motivated was that the class was an hour and a half. Actually, initially, I think there were maybe 45 minutes. But it's longer than the 10, 15-minute instructions on a retreat. And so I then I thought, those instructions are so brief. There's so much more to say about the instructions for each of these things. So I want more time. So initially I had 45 minutes and then eventually became an hour and a half. In order to go into some real explanations, real care around how to teach mindfulness of each of these areas. And so I kind of made up this course that way. And that's what I've been doing, and other people at IMC have been doing now for almost 30 years. I think it works very well. But it's only one way of practicing, one way of giving the instructions. In the pandemic earlier this year, I gave like 60 or so talks that were basically instructions on mindfulness of breathing according to the Anapanasati technique. And that's a whole other way of practicing, which I find tremendously valuable, but it is different. I've been asked now repeatedly to do a similar series on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which if you take that as your primary instructions, is a little bit different again. It's a little different technique. So these are all kinds of realize there's all these different ways of doing it. And so And so my hope in offering the classic now for 30 years, the way it's done here at IMC, on this, you know, sequentially, is that even if you don't take that as the core technique, in a sense, it's laying a very good foundation for how to include breathing, body, emotions, thinking, in whatever technique you do. You become wiser, you're more understanding. I've also hoped in teaching this at IMC this way, that it's also relevant for people who never meditate, that people in their ordinary life will also find it useful to understand some of the principles, ideas that I teach around breathing, body, emotions, and thinking, and the rest of it. And when I do interclass, I'm trying to kind of make it relevant in such a broad way. So that's kind of like the background. And so some of you, I want to hopefully prevent a little bit of confusion if some of you come to the 7 a.m. teaching and say, wait a minute, just earlier in the year we had this all 60 steps, you know, the 16 steps, the 60 talks about it on Anapanasati. Now, how does this fit in? So I hope this helps a little bit. And in terms of the Satipatthana Sutta, I'm planning next year to do a series on it. Then probably do a little gap before I do it, after doing this current series on the basic instructions here. And hopefully the basic instructions here will be tremendously supportive for understanding Satipatthana. So there are these basic instructions. And as a beginner, the instructions are more prescriptive, meaning these are the things that we do. For someone who, as we mature, there starts to be a shift in the practice where it becomes less and less something we do and more something we allow. So it becomes more and more, the so-called instructions are no longer prescriptive, they become descriptive. So it's more and more that we are discovering a capacity for being aware here, and then we're just receptive in a certain way, and then we're aware of breathing. And so it isn't so much we're following instructions to be with the breathing. Breathing has found us, and that's where the practice is. Sometimes the body speaks up, and so then we're aware of the body. It's the loudest thing happening. And so that's what fills this autonomous, independent kind of capacity just to be aware. Sometimes emotions, sometimes thoughts, sometimes other aspects of all this. And so awareness becomes more something we allow. It develops certain independence. It's not being directed necessarily, but it might be very specific if one thing is the loudest thing. But it's not like we're doing it. It's more like we're allowing it. And over time, as practice matures, and there's some degree, some experience, some taste of what freedom is like, then the awareness shares with some of the qualities of that freedom. That it's still the basic practice, but it's accompanied by a sense of what freedom is, or a feel for freedom, and disenchantment, and these qualities that come from a sense of freedom and independence that I call it for autonomy. That there's a sense that awareness becomes more autonomous. Not that you become autonomous, because that's dangerous in terms of conceit. Like, I look at me, I'm autonomous and capable, independent. The idea that you are independent, that you are anything, is not really needed in the freedom and the ease and the peace of autonomous awareness. And so the autonomous awareness, the awareness that can just be, has lent itself to, like in the West, to language of to have non-judgmental awareness, to have an awareness that's accepting of everything, to have open awareness, to have, there was a time that what was popular was something called choiceless awareness. And so over time, there are different trends about how to talk about this. And the current trend as of today, here with me, is to talk about it in terms of being autonomous. Autonomous awareness. And as practice deepens, as I said, rather than that mindfulness is something we do, mindfulness is something we allow. We allow that autonomy of awareness that is not entangled or caught up or for and against any experience. And then it becomes more and more kind of a marvel, kind of a wondrous thing, that there is this free feeling of awareness that's free and independent and not pushed around, not attached to anything, not for anything or against anything. And then everything else becomes nature. Even things which are unfortunate, say that you're angry with someone, that in a hostile with someone in a very unfortunate way. The autonomy means that you're not going to give into it. You're not going to participate in it. The forces of hostility and anger exists within you, but this precious core of who we kind of sense are, the awareness, allows us just to leave it alone. And maybe seeing it, it's not identifying with it. And this is one of the characteristics of a mature practitioner, is that there's less and less identification with whatever the experience is. Identification here means that we define ourselves by it. We limit ourselves, and this is who I am. We hold on to it. We grab onto it, and now I know who I am. That immediately limits the range and the wholeness, the fullness of the experience. And it's not a denial of certain appropriate identities that people have. It's the movement of movements of the identification that we have that is the issue. And so as practice matures, it's still the same practice, but what we're doing is we are no longer identifying with these things. And so we are, and so everything we see then becomes nature. That it becomes just part of the process, and that kind of independence, being having those two meet, to hold in awareness whatever the experience is, breath, body, emotions, thoughts, challenges, pain, suffering, whatever it might be, it's a remarkable process, because then the natural functioning of who we are begins to operate better and better. And this idea of being able to feel the freedom and allowance of a natural functioning that comes when we don't restrict nature, we don't limit it, we don't bottle it up, we don't become attached to it. And the understanding of Buddhism is that all the unhealthy ways that we live our lives, all the ways that we cause harm to ourselves and others, comes from not leaving things alone, not letting things equilibrate, come to harmony. It comes from entanglement, wanting, contracting around something, resisting something, judging something, identifying with something in a heavy, burdensome way. So the instructions are very simple, basic, and the more one has practiced them, then basic instructions become even more relevant than they were when you were a beginner, because of what accompanies it. Because now there's a sense and a feeling and a possibility of having it be simpler and simpler. And simpler is not simplistic. Simpler is where our freedom is found. So that's the introduction. And hopefully, for those of you who are not going to come to the 7 a.m., hopefully that was nice for you. And And for those of you who do, I certainly look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning, or seeing you, being with you. And we will hopefully go through it in a way that all of us, including me, find valuable and meaningful. So thank you. And so now, those of you who want to meet with, go to the meeting that Jan and Barry are hosting, you can join the YouTube and the Zoom room, and I'm going to post it here again, and then I think I can do it right now. Let's see. Yeah, there it is. So hopefully that gives you, there's a password. The password is Sangha, S-A-N-G-H-A, with a capital S. But the link there actually has the password embedded in it. So you might have to copy and paste because there's so much more. I didn't quite do it. Let me see if I can. There it is. So there it is. So it's underlined, so it probably means you can click on it. So thank you all, and wish you all a good week.